You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Welcome. I am Michaela Novak, Senior Fellow with the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. The podcast episode today is one element of a three-part Hayek Program podcast series on entangled political economy. Entangled political economy is a sub-discipline of mainline political economy that explicitly views individuals and the private and public sectors as being intertwined in overlapping exchange relationships along competitive and collaborative dimensions. Inspired by a long tradition in political economy stretching back to Adam Smith and Karl Menger, and drawing upon insights found in complexity, evolutionary, and network theories, entangled political economy studies have expanded significantly in recent years. Entangled political economy researchers have established a research network to promote the research and study of entangled political economy. This body, called the Entangled Political Economy Research Network, or EPERN for short, was established in 2020, and I am an associate director of that network. It is my great privilege to speak to David Hebert, who is also an associate director of EPERN. Dave Hebert was recently appointed as Senior Research Fellow in Research and Education at the American Institute for Economic Research. Hebert was the chair of the Department of Economics and Associate Professor of Economics at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He has previously been an assistant professor at Ferris State University from 2014 to 2016 and at Troy University from 2016 to 2017. Dave Hebert graduated with a bachelor's degree in economics from Hillsdale College in 2009 and then attended George Mason University, where he earned a master's in 2011 and a doctorate in 2014. Dave Hebert's research works have been published in a variety of outlets, including Public Choice, Journal of Public Finance and Public Choice, and Constitutional Political Economy. And he has co-edited with Diana Thomas the Springer publication entitled Emergence, Entanglement, and Political Economy. So Dave, welcome. It is a great pleasure to have you as a guest for this episode of the Hayek Program Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. You know, it's such a great treat to get to talk to you and to be here today. So thank you.
Yeah, likewise, for sure. So I would like to start out with something of a personal and scholarly reminisce of your interactions with the great Dick Wagner, emeritus professor here at George Mason University. Now, as you and I both know, and as our listeners will learn soon enough, Richard Wagner is the progenitor of the entangled political economy framework, which is the very subject of this Hayek Program podcast miniseries. So, before turning to some of the substantive scholarly issues at play, what are some of your personal reflections of being mentored by Wagner and of being his co-author, in fact, on several key papers? What was it like to be a student and later collaborator of Dick's?
Yeah, I mean, being in Dick's classes was just an amazing experience all around. You know, he really drove home the idea that we're here and we're there to undertake, you know, a joint inquiry. And this, you know, to kind of set some basic idea behind this, you know, that puts a tremendous amount of work on his plate that, frankly, you know, he didn't need to do. But he did so because that's just, you know, how charitable he actually is. So every week, you know, either Dick would present in the class on something that he was working on, or we would present on, you know, a paper proposal that we had put together, you know, that week. And I mean, if it wasn't that day, like right after class, it was the next morning. Every single one of us had, you know, multiple paragraphs of feedback of, you know, here's some thoughts on what your proposal was. Here's some relevant literature that you might want to engage in. Here are some things that you might want to clarify. I mean, it was just incredible. You know, he could have easily just written back, you know, 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 10 out of 10, whatever. But he took the time, you know, to really kind of mentor every single student. In fact, I still have all of the emails from his classes, including PDFs of my paper proposals. And if I'm being completely honest, a lot of what I've done in my career is just finishing things that I started in his classes with the comments that he gave me. You know, going into his office was absolutely incredible. I would joke with him in a somewhat frustrating way that I would walk into his office with, you know, what I thought was one clear question, and I'd walk out with eight somewhat opaque questions that, you know, clearly needed to be answered if I were to try to answer my original question. The second thing about it is I think I can count on one hand the number of times that his door was closed while he was in the office during my entire time at Mason. Now, that doesn't sound super impressive to, you know, non-academics, but the fact of the matter is, like, as faculty, you know, we're always pulled in a million directions at once by a lot of, you know, what could only be described as minutia. And so the temptation to just simply close one's door and plow through the mountain of administrativa is incredibly tempting. But Dick never once succumbed to that. Instead, his door was always open. And whenever you went into his office, he would immediately stop whatever it was that he was doing and give you his absolute full attention. Now, I've been out of graduate school now for 10 years. And, you know, that memory has served as sort of an inspiration of something to try to live up to. But I will fully confess that my door is closed more often than Dick's was. But that's, you know, a shortcoming of me. And the best part about, you know, just walking into Dick's office without an appointment, without anything, is that you could tell that he just enjoyed it. He enjoyed meeting with students. And he never once thought about the simple fact that by virtue of you going into his office, it meant that he'd have to work a little bit later into the night. Now, in terms of being a collaborator with Dick, again, it was just amazing. There's no real way to see someone's thought process without being a co-author with them. And so in this sense, you know, I got kind of an unparalleled insight into, you know, how it is that Dick works through puzzles. And in doing so, I got to learn one way in which that I could start looking through puzzles. You know, watching the drafts of our papers change over time as we discussed things, as I added some thoughts to our draft, and as we learned more, you know, again, I want to emphasize that we did all this together. It was just such a treat. And I think for every page that Dick and I actually published, there's probably at least 10 pages of things that didn't get published that, frankly, I could probably go back to and start mining for more paper ideas. So really, it was a wonderful experience. I can't thank Dick enough for his openness and his incredible willingness to work with, you know, literally everyone. I'm trying to be, you know, sensitive to not offending his sense of humility, but it's really hard when someone is just that kind of incredible.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much for that account. So there were a couple of things there that sort of jump out to me that are sort of quite evident when sort of thinking about economic pedagogy and strategy. So it seems to me just a couple of themes that you sort of stated there is that, first of all, Wagner probably appears to have adopted very much a similar line of procession through classes like his mentor Buchanan. So from whatever I've read about Buchanan, seems that Wagner's basically replicated a similar sort of model, at least for graduate students, so where you're sort of basically engaging in some sort of joint production or even sort of co-productive activity along sort of new sort of intellectual sort of lines and pathways. So there's that. But then the other thing too, and it brought a smile to my face, I must admit, is when you referred to You know, you're having some sort of engagement with Wagner with one question and you come out with 10. Now, that actually sounds like Buchanan's teacher, Frank Knight, who had a sort of a particular style of intellectual inquiry, which served to actually provide, outline, articulate more questions than necessarily answers. So that's really interesting. And I would say as an observation, should you succeed, and I'm sure you have been indeed, in sort of replicating that sort of Wagnerian style of teaching and economic communication, especially in your new appointment, which is the AIER, you'll be certainly sort of following in some prominent footsteps in that regard. So that's fantastic. So one of the important papers in the entangled political economy tradition is one you co-produced with Wagner and published in 2014 in the Journal of Public Finance and Public Choice. So this paper of both Dick and yours is entitled, and I quote, "Taxation as a Quasi-Market Process, Explanation, Exhortation, and the Choice of Analytical Windows." There was a follow-up paper I noticed that you authored yourself, named Microcatalytic Public Finance, which is one that I often myself draw upon. So the idea from both of those papers is that public finance may be interpreted as a so-called catalactical process, and that's an intriguing one, given the predominance of the view, even in Wagner's teacher James Buchanan time, we've mentioned Buchanan, that public finance is modelled or ought to be modelled somehow as an object of policymaking. Now, that sort of line of inquiry in public finance, the conventional line of inquiry, seems to be quite in contrast to the two papers, the first one that you co-authored with Dick, the second one you produced yourself. So here in the sort of the conventional notion of public finance, a benevolent despot, as it were, can twist a tax rate knob here, press a spending program button there, and magically, seemingly, all is right in the world. But could you describe for our listeners the underlying research motivation of your papers, which clearly articulate an alternative line and approach of public finance? And what were the main conclusions from your two papers going back admittedly a fair while?
Yeah, so most people who study, you know, taxes and spending policies, et cetera, will look at sort of, you know, what is the intended outcome of the proposal? And then they'll kind of trace through sort of unintended consequences, you know, later on down the road. So I'm reminded of recent work in this. You know, former President Trump says he wants to have a 10% tariff on all imports. And the idea is that doing so would protect domestic industries. You know, that's true. Like, it will, but it comes at a cost. And most economists will then, you know, say, hey, there's going to be unintended consequences. Those unintended consequences are going to be quite large. Your intended consequences are going to be quite small by comparison, right? And so on net, this is a bad idea from a policy standpoint. It's going to do more harm than good, right? And what Dick and I wanted to do, and these two papers and several other, you know, works that are on my CV and in the pipeline, so to speak, stems from this idea that is from a conversation, frankly, with Dick in my second year, I believe, when I said, you know, hey, it's kind of weird that democracies around the world have these really complicated, you know, tax codes, right? If we take sort of the Oliver Wendell Holmes approach to understanding taxes and just view them as, you know, a price for civilized society, well, then tax codes should just be like a menu at a restaurant, right? And, you know, I've been to restaurants and some of them have, you know, menus that are multiple pages long. But I've never seen a 400 or 70,000 page menu at any restaurant, right? And so if taxes are mere prices, and I should clarify that 400 or 70,000, the U.S. tax code is so complicated that there's legitimate debate about whether the tax code itself is 400 pages long or over 70,000 pages long, right? And so this can't be a formatting issue. This is like a deep, like philosophical, like what does it mean to be a tax code, you know, issue. And so like that's how complicated this whole mess is, right? Is we don't even know what to count as a page toward this thing. And so if that's the case, if taxes are merely prices, then tax codes should be relatively simple, right? And there's more to it than that. There has to be. So what Dick and I wanted to explore together, and what I'm still exploring, is the process by which a tax code actually gets created. Now, normally we model this and we say, you know, hey, there's one person or a representative agent that, you know, writes the whole thing, right? And so that one person, you know, is going to have transitive preferences. They're going to be rational. There's going to be no contradictions. There's going to be no, you know, weird things floating around in there, because normally people don't do weird things, right? But if you start digging into the tax code, you know, there's all these loopholes, there's all these other things, and those loopholes are sometimes intentional, but oftentimes they're a result of ambiguity, right? There's just two passages that are at odds. And so how can you have a deliberative, almost planned quality to a tax code that has within itself contradictions, ambiguities, and things that seem to cut against one another? That doesn't really make sense. And so what Dick and I wanted to do is take, you know, what is traditionally viewed as like a market phenomenon of emergence, right, where we always say, and economists are great at this, Austrian economists in particular, about celebrating, you know, market outcomes as being emergent or having an emergent quality to them, and say, well, can't some of this apply to state or political outcomes, right? Pushing back a little bit on the sort of deliberative or almost planned quality that most people seem to think comes out of Congress. Okay. And so in this sense, what we tried to point out is that there's not really one person who wrote the tax code, and there's not really even one body that wrote the tax code, right? What the tax code is more than just what Congress and the president agree to, but also what the Supreme Court rules on. It's going to depend on any what are called technical amendments that the IRS releases. And there's a whole host of other programs that bureaucracies in Washington get to decide on. You know, they can define things certain ways, they can define standards in different ways, and they can change those definitions. And all those things act to change the taxes that you and I and other people in the US ultimately end up paying. And so we can further complicate this, as Dick and I tried to do, by noting that there is this notion that tax codes are written and amended, you know, through time. And so now what the tax code is, you know, if we could ever settle that debate, what it is at any one moment is going to depend not just on today, but also on the past. And so what we wanted to do in our work and in work that has extended this is to say, you know, hey, there's something here that's emergent. This isn't simply a planning problem that we would normally see. And it's not just an institutional problem either. It's more. It's not just, you know, poor or perverse incentives, but also it's about, you know, what is the feedback mechanism, to borrow some language from Davide DeMarco, that is guiding these adjustments? Who is going to receive that feedback? And then what are their capabilities to actually respond to that feedback? And so Dick and I just wanted to take, you know, a thing that we understood as market outcomes as being emergent and apply that to political outcomes as well. Where it ties into entangled political economy is the notion that anytime you're going to, you know, change a bill or anything of that sort, or propose a change to some policy, you're going to hold hearings. And those hearings are going to have not just members of Congress, but also and bureaucracies and departments and et cetera, but it's going to have members of industry, of business, of the common citizenry. They're going to come weigh in on it too. And so that's where you're going to get some of that feedback from the private sector into public orderings, right? And that all needs to be taken into account if you're going to actually describe where policies, in our case, where the tax code, where it actually comes from.
No, that's terrific. And I think the two papers in question are a sort of wonderful demonstration of the value of entangled political economy. So if you take the mainstream sort of conception of public finance, there'll be some observation by an external observer, perhaps sort of sitting in either an ivory tower or, you know, sitting in a sort of government office in a certain agency, who observes a state or a condition of the world that is regarded as undesirable on some ground. Let's say the usual refrain given is that of a market failure. And according to this sort of conventional notion of public finance, this policymaker sitting wherever they may be overwrites the sort of the manuscript, and this is Dick's own language, the manuscript of society according to the preferred ends of the advisor. So what you're suggesting in summary of your two papers is that entangled political economy obviously provides a quite radical distinction in terms of our thinking of public finance. So we have, as you've mentioned, the evolution of the tax code, and it can be any sort of other legal provision for that matter, as a sort of dynamic, complex process, almost like in sociological terms, a field, but I would even grant you even more dynamic interpretation of a field than a lot of sociologists would grant. So you have multiple actors who are engaging in a sort of a focal point of shared interest, right? Taxes, and then obviously taxes have distributional implications. Who pays the taxes? Well, preferably not me or someone else, an unwilling third party in society. And so that process carries through over time. And so from that, it seems to me that if we take the entangled orientation of public finance, then it's no longer a puzzle as to why, for example, the Secretary of the Australian Treasury, Ken Henry, about 15, 20 years ago said that the Australian tax code, for example, has evolved beyond human comprehension. Now, according to a conventional public finance perspective, that does represent a puzzle, but in the sort of the originating sort of papers that, you know, you've co-authored with Dick and yourself, it's entirely explainable. Certainly, it's true, nonetheless, that the tax codes have evolved beyond human comprehension, but you want to understand and explain the underlying processes, which I think both of your sort of papers had achieved.
Yeah. So you mentioned that, and that I think is really a key insight about, you know, tax codes in democracies in particular are so complicated that they're beyond human comprehension. Well, let's back up a second and say, you know, hey, isn't democracy supposed to deliver what the majority of people want, right? As just a first approximation, right? And if you go walk and talk to anyone on the streets, anywhere, you know, in the world and say, hey, do you think that, you know, your country's tax code could be simpler, right? All of them, I'm willing to bet, are going to say, yeah, right? And do you think that there should be fewer loopholes for, you know, ne'er-do-wells to exploit, right? And they'll say, of course, right? And every year, democracy produces the opposite, right? And so normal, you know, public choice people would say, yeah, it's a rent creation story, it's a rent capture story, you know, lobbying, logic of collective action, you know, okay, Dick and I don't disagree with any of that. But we're trying to show a new or alternative framework where it's sort of a perverse emergent outcome.
Yeah, that's right. So understanding sort of a collectical mode of public finance in various instances as perverse emergent orders, which are certainly not intended on the part of any singular individual or even sort of certain body. That's right. So if I may, so we can turn to another contribution of yours, which I think is quite outstanding. And so this is another paper in collaboration with Wagner in a 2018 issue of the journal Constitutional Political Economy. So the title of the paper we want to discuss now is as follows. It's called, and I quote, Political Parties, Insights from a Triplanar Model of Political Economy. So putting some notable exceptions aside, it seems that political parties are analytically treated as veritable black boxes in conventional mainstream political economy, if they're considered at all. So why political actors would coalesce into political parties and bear the organizational and political transaction costs of doing so is utterly mysterious under the mainstream view. So my question to you is, how does your paper help us unravel this apparent mystery of the political party? And what does your contribution offer, potentially in terms of future research effort for scholars out there?
Yeah, so political parties represent, just to me, a really fascinating opportunity for further study. So traditionally, political parties, if they've been modeled at all, have been modeled in one of a few kind of broad ways. The political party could simply be a label, you know, that helps reduce the amount of information that voters need in order to cast, you know, an informed vote at the ballot box. So, you know, you see that R next to someone's name, you know some things about them are most likely true. You see in the U.S. a D next to their name, you know some other things are probably true. We could model and have modeled political parties as sort of a clearinghouse of sorts for log rolling activities that act to enforce, you know, vote trading agreements. So it's no secret that, you know, elected officials will trade votes with one another to try to get, you know, more things passed. And so the challenge is in elected office, you know, your votes are public record. You can see exactly how, you know, everyone voted. Well, if I've promised you that I'm going to vote for your bill that's, you know, coming onto the floor, let's say tomorrow, right, in exchange for your vote on my bill today, we have kind of a principal agent problem, right? I could always just renege on our agreement. And so you need some means to enforce those agreements. And so I believe it's Thomas Stratman has written a lot on this one. You could model political parties as a means of enforcing those agreements and being able to detect and punish, you know, people who defect. You could also view political parties as a sort of a union, if you will, to recall Dennis Hastert's famous a majority of the majority rule, where, you know, if there were almost certainly sufficient votes in the chamber to pass a motion, well, if the majority of the majority didn't vote for it, then the Speaker of the House would refuse to bring it to the floor. In effect, really limiting the powers of a minority party, right? Or in more recent times, we've started modeling political parties as a means of pooling and then subsequently disseminating campaign contributions. So it's right now, it makes very little sense for, you know, a Democratic candidate to spend a whole lot of money, you know, seeking re-election or election in, let's say, California, right? Just like it probably makes more sense today, but traditionally it makes very little sense for a Republican to spend a whole lot of money on their campaign in Texas, right? But you could, in theory at least, you know, pool those resources and then send more money to the closer races, right? And so maybe that's one way that we could look at political parties as sort of establishing sort of a commons, but then piecing it out to individual people, right? And so we could do it that way. And so Dick and I thought, you know, there might be something a little bit more to this. And we started this paper a while ago. It took us a while to actually finish this paper. I think it was like 3 years at least, a year and a half of which it was under review, which was a fun process to say the least. But we were puzzled as to, you know, how is it that what do political parties actually do? Why do the American people, you know, care at some level? And so as we say in the paper, you know, we don't want to contradict any of these previous theories, you know, with our paper. Instead, we want to chart a different idea. And our idea is, I think, relatively simple, but I really liked it. And our idea is that political parties play a non-neutral way in framing issues in such a way that are palatable to potential voters. And so the idea is, you know, whenever there's an issue, there are different ways to frame that issue, and those need to be kind of agreed upon and then kind of put out there to voters. And so political parties are sort of that intermediary between the issue and the voter, okay? And so We give the example in our paper of wind farms. Now, we were really careful to try to not wade into the waters of, you know, energy policy. But we tried to point out that, you know, hey, the question of wind farms is actually a lot more complicated than one might think. So are wind farms overprovided because of subsidies, right? Or are they underprovided by, you know, a free market and therefore in need of some form of Pigouvian subsidies to correct it, right? Again, you know, Dick and I kind of eschew, you know, those frameworks of thinking, but traditional economists don't. And so we try to couch it in those terms. Now, I'm not so sure that that question is really easy to answer with just theory, right? And so where you stand on that issue likely depends, at least in part, on how you see that issue, which is influenced by how you frame that issue. And so what Dick and I wanted to argue in our paper is that political parties have at least some capacity to frame issues in such a way that they then influence the actual outcome of, you know, any type of vote. Now, in many ways, we tried to argue a lot of what Randy Holcomb does in his book, Following Their Leaders. Though, you know, full credit to Randy, he did a much, much more thorough and a much, much deeper dive into this than Dick and I did. Though if I may chide Randy a little bit, I don't know if he cited Dick and I's paper. So perhaps in the second edition of his book, which is fantastic, but perhaps then. But yeah, it was just a great, fun project to work on, you know, thinking about big ideas. There's plenty of big ideas, but what are political parties and what are their role in society is a huge question. And one that, again, I really want to get back to. And I've gotten back to it a couple times. So I have a 2019 paper on the chairman's solution, which spawned from, you know, reading Buchanan and talking to Ken Shepsley, actually, at a Public Choice Society meetings years and years ago. And, you know, Ken's advice was really prescient for me at the time. He said, you know, hey, just take a model that someone else did, make a small tweak to it, and see what comes out. And so what I did in that paper is just say, hey, you know, there's all this like work on, like, especially by Munger and Munger on, you know, a spatial model of majority rules and everything. Well, what if we just pretended that political parties were things? What would that do to the model? And it turns out it does quite a bit. It's just political parties are such a fun thing to think about. I'm actually in the beginning stages of working on another paper on political parties with one of Aquinas College's recent graduates who is hopefully going off to Georgetown University next year for his master's in political science. We're still trying to find funding for him, but we're getting there slowly but surely. But he and I are working on a paper together, trying to figure out, you know, so every election cycle, it seems that everyone around the world will say things like, I can't believe it comes down to these two people. You know, this is the worst pairing ever. Well, the only way that can be true is if the quality of candidates is steadily declining, right? I mean, we said it in, you know, 2008, we said it in 2012, we're saying it today, right? And I suspect we're going to say it again in 2028 as well. And so what is it about democracy that is systematically choosing low quality and lower quality candidates, at least in the eyes of the general public? Now, maybe there's an element of hyperbole that people are using when they're describing and lamenting the current choices. I don't dispute that. But we want to try to take people at their word and say, you know, hey, if it is the case that it's getting worse, well, what's causing that? Or at the very least, try to answer the question, why isn't it just getting a little bit better?
No, that's excellent. There's plenty of food for thought from the sort of the comments that you're relating to from your 2018 paper. So it's, I wonder whether, you know, to some extent, sort of Hayek's classic sort of argument why the worst get on top may sort of play some explanatory role, especially in your sort of forthcoming work. So as you know, but maybe listeners are certainly not so aware that Hayek sort of exposits the thesis that politics will tend to select for certain personalities with certain what I would call coercive skills, and then that sort of perhaps informs some of the observations with respect to the intertemporal decline of political candidature. There are probably broader compositional issues as well. I know from my own home country, it's often said that 20, 30, 40, 50, even more years ago, the base of political party selection for the major parties seems to be a lot much more diverse then than now. So where you have, and I think this is probably also the case in the US, where many of the sort of the candidates that are selected or pre-selected for office will either be members of labor unions, in the case of the Democrats, or the Australian Labor Party, or what have you, or perhaps even now the sort of the right of center parties will be sort of ministerial staffers. So there may be those sort of dimensions as well. So that sort of research, I'm really thrilled to hear that you're certainly persisting along this sort of line of inquiry. One side issue, thinking about political parties, but I think it kind of resonates maybe with the informational sort of function of political parties that you outlined. First of all, I've often wondered and often sort of held to the view that political parties sort of serve as ideological rationing devices. Now, that might not only serve sort of the Downsian kind of function of the political party, but it actually might sort of fit in quite well with your sort of work with Wagner about the efficacy of political parties as collective vehicles to frame. So if the framing is ideological nature, then the connections are sort of quite obvious. But if I can make just a final point on that, because I think many of the points you made are really fascinating. So, without publicizing too much of my own sort of efforts, I have a sort of paper forthcoming in the Review of Austrian Economics, identifying the processual nature of social problems from an entangled political economy perspective. And if there is a deficiency, even with that sort of forthcoming piece of work, it's the need to actually better integrate this really curious phenomena that you've examined so well so far, that is of the political party as a specialized sort of organizational promulgator of framings in their own right. So that's really very important. So if I may sort of then briefly turn, because I'm wondering whether the paper of yours on the chairman's problem is the same one I have in mind to discuss now. So in the 2019 edition of Advances in Austrian Economics, there was another published paper of yours entitled The Spontaneous Order of Politics. So I'm wondering if you can just describe for our listeners what is this spontaneous approach to politics that you speak of, and how might it vary from the standard or mainstream public choice account of politics?
Yeah, so this was part of the Wirth seminar series up in Canada, and I feel awful because I can't remember what school it was at, but it was just wonderful. It was with, Steve Horwitz was there, Lynn Kiesling was there, Richard Ebeling was there. I actually met Vincent Geloso, your colleague there, for the very first time, which the first time anyone meets Vincent is quite the experience, to say the least. But if you can imagine a younger, brasher Vincent, that's the one I met. So it was thoroughly enjoyable. But there were just so many people, and I'm glossing over lots of names. And if you were there too, I sincerely apologize for skipping over you. I mean no disrespect. But I made a remark there that caused Steve, Richard, and Lynn especially to get really kind of uncomfortable, but also excited. And my remark was that when it comes to policies, there doesn't really seem to be a scarcity issue, in the sense that, just because I've written a policy saying, we're going to do X has been passed, it doesn't mean you can't pass a policy that says we're going to do Y, right? There's no real you could think about, what is the trade-off? Well, the trade-off is maybe, 10% instead of 11%. Like, that's certainly a trade-off there. But, what would it mean to think about sort of planned reconciliation within the context of politics, right? And I'm reminded, of course, of Dick's work as politics as a peculiar business, right? Where you have differing enterprises competing to try to get, you know, certain things done. And that's all well and good. And I don't dispute anything that, that Dick is saying in that book or elsewhere. But I guess my question there was, you know, what does it mean to have, like, for a policy to have an opportunity cost? And if that's the case, then how can we start thinking about the trade-offs that that people in office are facing? And how can we think about where, you know, any policy actually ultimately comes from? So it's returning to, you know, the same work that that Dick and I have been doing on, you know, tax codes as an emergent phenomenon, but trying to extend it a little bit more to not just tax codes, but really all policy, right? All policy has to have at least some emergent quality to it. Now, how emergent is it? You know, I don't know. That's a great question. What do the, you know, what is the range of emergence look like between, you know, centrally planned and fully emergent? I don't know, right? How would you describe that continuum? Again, I don't really know that I have answers, but trying to put, you know, thoughts out on those issues was the main goal of that chapter. And the wonderful thing about, you know, edited volumes is, you know, it's not that they're easier to get into, but at the same time, you're going to get a very friendly reviewer. You're going to get an editor who is, you know, going to give you a fair shake and is going to understand more of what you're trying to do, and will in turn help make the paper, you know, better. You know, had I sent that book chapter to, for example, the American Economic Review, one, it would have been desk rejected, as it should have been, right? It's not up to snuff for that journal. I don't dispute that for a single second. But I wouldn't have gotten any feedback, even if, you know, it had been sent out. There's no chance that I would have gotten feedback that would make it better. But with Steve, Richard, and Lynn in the room, and so many others, again, apologies to those of you that were there, I did get great feedback. And it was just such a wonderful, you know, project to get to work on, and opportunity to learn from, you know, tremendous scholars in the field of Austrian economics.
Terrific. So let's now sort of turn our thoughts to some current research and future directions in entangled political economy. So since your highly productive period of scholarly learning and advancement at George Mason University, you've certainly gone ahead to continue to advance important contributions, in my opinion, not only in terms of intellectual inquiry, but more recently, until now, with your latest appointment with respect to university administration at Aquinas College. So I'd like to know one of the many post-GMU contributions you'd made, particularly the co-edited book with Diana Thomas called Emergence, Entanglement, and Political Economy. I referred to this in my opening monologue. So I'm wondering if you could tell us more about this book, including some of the intellectual highlights of the volume in your humble and maybe even biased opinion, and the motivation for this contribution. Why was that book important in your view to marshal collaborators into a joint work, consciously integrating emergence and entanglement in an entangled political economy spirit?
Yeah, so the edited volume, you know, has a really fascinating origin story that, you know, I really think speaks volumes to why, and now I'm admitting I'm biased here, but I have evidence to back it up, to why GMU is just the greatest place to go for graduate school. So all of the faculty there, and not just Dick, are so open and willing to discuss and engage with graduate students. You know, if I extend the open door story from Dick, I think I'm still at one hand the number of times I saw a door closed at GMU when a faculty member was in their office. And so, you know, I would talk to all the faculty as much as humanly possible. You know, I used to go running with, you know, Chris Coyne and Abby Hall at least twice per week. I got to play golf with Pete Becky. I would go bug Pete Leeson at cigar shops around town. And all of this was just ways of me trying to lower the cost to them of talking about economics and the economics profession, and also to have fun. You know, there was a ton of that. So through Pete Leeson, I met and became friends with one of the higher-ups at Springer, which is the publisher of the edited volume. And this person and I actually, we still exchange Christmas cards every year. He's become a dear friend. And he asked me if I had any ideas for an edited volume. You know, I said I did, and immediately went, it was at a public choice society meetings, I went and found Diana, who is just a phenomenal scholar and just an incredibly amazing person. And so we put together a list of contributors, put together the proposal for Springer, and then set about, you know, getting it done. Now, in terms of putting it together, or why we put it together, I think it was important because it accomplished kind of two things. So first, it put out there, you know, a book from a reputable publisher on entangled political economy that had sort of a swelling, you know, idea behind it. And second, it showed that there were actually plenty of people working in this tradition and that there was a movement that was already, you know, well underway. So I was really proud of that work. And then another piece of advice that another GMU alum gave me, who I will not name, he said, you know, writing a book is really easy if you get other people to write it for you. And so we got, you know, seven of our friends or so to write a chapter for our book, and now we have a book. So in terms of important contributions and future directions, you know, from that book, in terms of, you know, what the important contributions are, you know, I don't want to call any papers out. I will say this. First off, you can get a PDF of it for free on Springer's website, which is just fantastic. And I have reread this book and the chapters in it probably a dozen times over the years at least. And every time I do, I am just stunned with the brilliance of everyone else in this book. And it's incredible. I was really pleased with how it came out. I know Diana was as well. It's just been a real treat. And I still learn new things every time I read each of those chapters.
Yes, and I have to say I share the sort of sentiment with you as well. Every time I open the book, and I do quite frequently, there's always new insights. And so, you know, if anything, that's an indicator for a great book. And as you've said, Dave, it is freely available on the Springer website. So people, if interested, can certainly go and check it out. So in terms of another question. So, as indicated in my sort of preamble, you are also a deputy executive director of the Entangled Political Economy Research Network. So I've already made the disclaimer that I'm also a part of the executive team of that body, and it has over 70 scholar members from around the world with an interest in this budding field, growing field, actually, of entangled political economy. I'm wondering, and this is probably a question in the sort of spirit of blue sky thinking, what do you see as some of the more promising newer research directions taken in the field? And how might you see entangled political economy as evolving in the near to medium term? Again, very much a blue sky question style of thinking in relation to my question. But what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, so I have learned a lot from Dick Wagner over the years, not just in graduate school, but, you know, beyond. And I'm going to borrow something from him and say that I'm going to hesitate to make any prognostications about, you know, future directions of entangled political economy. I think there's just way too much creativity within and without the EPIRN members for me to be able to do such a thing. But what I will say is that I have been just so incredibly impressed with the diversity of backgrounds and approaches being taken in the vein of entangled political economy, particularly in our virtual seminar series. So just this past year, we had historians Hiram and Verlin Lewis come and present on their work, which was incredible. We had Santiago Jose Gangotena present on agent-based modeling and entangled political economy. You know, if you told me 3 years ago that we were going to be talking to historians and agent-based modelers as a part of entangled political economy, I would have thought you were nuts. And yet here we are. And so I think what I'm most excited about in the short, medium, and long term, when it comes to the future of entangled political economy, are the things that you and I and Marta and Dick cannot even imagine right now. And that will come from the combinations of ideas and the combinations of collaborators within and without this network. I really think it's just such a big topic that there's so much room for so much incredible creativity. And the ground is super fertile for new research And so I really just think this is the beginning of something really big in political economy.
No, you're very, very humble, and I appreciate that. I think that's a very, very fair call. I guess when I'm sort of thinking about what the future might look like, I mean, obviously nobody has a crystal ball, and it's foolish to make sort of predictions, especially about the future, as I would say. But if I could make sort of a couple of observations just from my experience with EPIRN and the sort of this growing network of entangled political economists. First thing I'll say is that your role within EPIRN and helping to organize the seminar sort of series, particularly recently, had been particularly valuable in terms of your own capacities to sort of bring to light the sheer diversity of topical scope, theoretical insight and empirical application of that underpins entangled political economy was a real highlight. So I think certainly sort of credit to you. And now I think I could probably just sort of restrict myself to generality to say that, look, certainly it'd be my view that entangled political economy is a living enterprise, most certainly, and the liveliness of the sub-discipline going forward will rest upon continuing theoretical and empirical innovation. So with respect to the latter, you referred to Gangatina's recent work in terms of agent-based modeling. Also see lots of potential with respect to network analysis and a broader sort of integration between entangled political economy and computational social sciences more broadly. So I certainly agree with you. It's a very exciting sort of future at hand. And so if I may, on our sort of last sort of question before wrapping up. So recently, and as I've sort of indicated in the preamble, you announced obviously some exciting professional news to the effect that you've now been appointed as a senior research fellow for the American Institute for Economic Research. So obviously, congratulations on that appointment. And I'm wondering, how might your intellectual interest in entangled political economy transfer to this more policy-oriented role? Do you see policy relevance for entangled political economy? And if so, how?
Yeah, so I absolutely do. And I'm really excited to be working with AIER. It's just such a great organization. You know, we have tons of summer opportunities, just to give you a quick plug on what we've got going on. And people should absolutely come apply and come hang out in Great Barrington for the summer and just do work, just do good work. It's just a really great organization. And I'm super excited to be joining them full time. In terms of entangled political economy and how it's going to cross into my work there, you know, I look at the work that Dick put out on macroeconomics and the shell games of policy and what's going on there. You know, that book has, I will fully admit, you know, I read the book when it came out and said, oh yeah, this is great. And then I kind of put it down. But now it's on my desk. It's right next to me all the time. I'm referring to it constantly and borrowing insights from it, trying to figure out, you know, hey, where do these policies actually come from? And that has been so incredibly fruitful in just the 2 weeks that I've been with AIER so far. You know, looking at, you know, trade deficits and trying to explain what those are. So I've got a series coming out in short order on those, and a longer form essay on, you know, what is the trade deficit? How do we calculate it? What's going on? How is it determined? What influences it? You know, all of that. So I really think that there's tremendous scope to kind of cross into the understanding current policy work through entangled political economy. Whether entangled political economy contributes to sort of a normative stance or not, you know, I don't know, right? I'm on the fence about it. The scientist in me says, you know, no, but the practitioner, I guess, at some level in me says, yeah, maybe. So, you know, I think there's scope there for increased discussion and insights and just new applications and new exhortations of old ideas that are being done in a new way.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for your time, Dave Hebert, now at the AIER. Thank you very much for your time, for appearing on the Hayek Program Podcast.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Michaela.
Anytime.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.